Before we proceed with the case, I would like to welcome South Milwaukee High School students. Are they here? Do they stand so we can see them? All right, you are here. Well, welcome. Won't you be seated, please? Now, are there Eau Claire students here? Would they stand, please? And are you from which school? Okay. Well, why aren't you standing? All right. Well, thank you and welcome to you. And now that the court has been introduced to our students who are here with our Court with Class program, I would like to introduce the court to the students and everyone else who is present in the courtroom. And I'll start with my far right, and that is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice John Wilcox. And to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babich. To his left is Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And at noon today, the students who are here will meet with Justice Geske in the courtroom to discuss the Supreme Court and its procedures. With those introductions, we will go to our first case, 95-2918, Paul Abraham versus General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. Representing the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Abraham, is James Colby. Mr. Colby, you may proceed.
Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court, this is a contract case. Paul Abraham is a resident of the state of Wisconsin. He entered into a contract with General Casualty Insurance Company, a resident of the state of Wisconsin. The contract provided for underinsured motorist coverage, optional coverage under Wisconsin law. Mr. Abraham negotiated for underinsured motorist coverage in Wisconsin. The policy that was provided to him provided that he would be a covered person under the policy of insurance that was issued to him. Specifically, the contract provided that Mr. Abraham, as a covered person, in the event he disputed a claim with General Casualty, would be required to commence his action in the county in which he resided, La Crosse County. And that action was governed by the rules of procedure and evidence applicable to La Crosse County. This is a contract case. The contract was entered into, fully performed, and breached by General Casualty in Wisconsin. There are three issues that are currently before the court. First and foremost, at least from Mr. Abraham's perspective, is whether or not Mr. Abraham's action is a foreign cause of action as provided for under 893.07. 893.07's predecessor, 293.245, provided for a borrowing of a foreign statute of limitations by a resident plaintiff and specifically referenced the personal injury action. 893.07 eliminates the language dealing with a resident plaintiff and now uses the language cause or causes of action. Mr. Abraham maintains that under the facts of this case does not rise to the level of a foreign cause of action. The tenor of General Casualty, and why we're here, is that General Casualty maintains that because Mr. Abraham was involved in an automobile accident while doing an internship in the state of Florida, that the mere fact that an automobile accident occurred in Florida somehow triggers or mandates the application of the borrowing statute in Wisconsin on the contract cause of action. The accident occurred in October of '88. Mr. Abraham his insurance company, General Casualty, breached their contract in Wisconsin in October of 1990. This court, in the Soloff case, has already addressed the distinction, I believe, in uninsured motorist cases, and has clearly held that a six-year statute of limitations as opposed to a three-year statute of limitations applies under these circumstances.
Let me ask you a question. If in the Florida action, and if there had been, I don't know if there even was filed before it was settled, but let's assume it had been filed, the other driver who was insured by State Farm had filed a counterclaim against Mr. Abraham, and General Casualty then would have had, I assume, a duty to defend and would have gone in. And then there would have also been the UIM claim thrown into it. Is it your position that the statute limitations for Florida would have applied to the counterclaim issues, but the UIM issues would have been controlled by Wisconsin law?
I think under the current status of the law, yes, it could indeed be. But more importantly, Florida allows for direct action against the insurer, in this case General Casualty, under Florida law. Had the accident occurred in Florida under the Kilbraith decision, that's what makes it somewhat unique. Under Kilbraith, an injured party in Florida can bring his claim directly against either the underinsured operator or alternatively the insurer, the underinsured carrier, which is a different situation than we have here, which is a situation under the language of the policy. Mr. Abraham's rights did not accrue until such time that he's recovered the full policy limits of the General Casualty policy. Under those circumstances, if we try to bring the same action here, bringing a direct action, assuming the action happened in Wisconsin, and we named the underinsured tortfeasor and General Casualty, General Casualty would promptly come in and move to dismiss on the basis that no claim or cause of action had accrued against them at that point in time. So we believe that there is a distinction to be made in addressing this issue, especially in light of the way the Florida law is drafted. I might also add, Your Honor, that the Florida court is in the minority of courts. The majority of the courts the majority of the jurisdictions have addressed this issue on when a UIM claim accrues, and the majority decision is that the UIM claim accrues on the date of the breach, not the date of the accident.
We don't get to any of those issues until we've decided whether it's a foreign cause of action. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, under the tort, under the borrowing statute, the tort is, you have the bright line rule. It's clearly the place of the accident. And it just seems to me that from uniformity or simplicity, wouldn't that be the way that the court should look at this, since the triggering event was clearly, nothing would be before us if we didn't have the incident in Florida. That's what triggered the whole process here. What's wrong with that argument?
Your Honor, I think that, first of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with the location of the injury, a bright line approach. Moreover, I don't think that there was anything wrong with the court's analysis using the center of gravity approach in Girton. And quite frankly, I think that the hybrid approach is the approach that Judge Crabb used in the Terranova case, where she basically said, let's look at what the last significant event was that gives rise to a suitable claim. I think the location of the injury, which, as the court's well aware, developed out of the tort context, I think that location of injury is fine in the tort context, because the tortfeasor doesn't get to contract with the insured as to where the tort is going to occur, who the tortfeasor is going to be, or when it would occur. So I think that it makes perfectly good sense to have a borrowing statute that looks at the location of the injury to prevent just exactly what the statute was enacted for, and that was to prevent forum shopping. But under the circumstances here, Your Honor, in our supplemental materials, we indicated to the court that there was a more recent decision, and that was the Fagan versus Doubleday case. That was a Seventh Circuit decision, and it deals with the borrowing statute. It's a tort claim, a multi-state libel claim. But I think it's very helpful and illustrative in this regard, and that is that the Fagan case allowed the plaintiff to continue his cause of action in libel, a tort, in Wisconsin, although the libelous conduct had taken place in other states. And what was significant about Fagan, and I think how it works into this court's analysis of the situation we have, is that the Seventh Circuit ultimately said there was an injury or more than one injury, and that one of the injuries occurred in Wisconsin. And that was all the Fagan court needed to bring the case out of the context of the borrowing statute. And so to specifically answer your question, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything wrong with the location of injury approach being used, keeping in mind that in Paul Abraham's case, Mr. Abraham wasn't injured by General Casualty until General Casualty breached the contract of insurance with him.
Mr. Colby, let me interrupt and ask you, when do you claim the breach occurred?
The breach occurred, Your Honor, when Paul Abraham demanded the settlement. It would be specifically October of 1990.
Well, did he both demand the settlement and demand arbitration?
He did not demand arbitration at that time.
So the last act, if you will, was the demand for arbitration, which was refused?
Yes, sir.
And when was that approximately?
It was subsequent to, I think as the record indicates, subsequent to the October 1990 instructions by General Casualty to go ahead and settle with the tortfeasor.
If you use the six-year statute of limitations from Wisconsin, your client's demand for payment falls within that statute of limitations. You don't have a statute of limitations.
It does, Your Honor. The action was, as a practical matter, the action was commenced within the six-year statute of limitations, even if we assume that we apply the date of the accident as opposed to the date of the breach. But if we apply the Florida borrowing statute, if we apply the Florida statute of limitations, and then we look at Florida substantive law for the date of accrual and use the date of the accident, it was not commenced within 5 years of the accident under Florida law.
And what's the tort statute of limitations in Florida? This within 5 years is a contract action, isn't it? For insurance?
The Florida statute, Your Honor, basically says that the UIM claim must be commenced within 5 years of the date of the accident.
When would you have to sue for the personal injury?
I believe that Florida has a 2-year tort statute of limitations.
That's what I'm asking. All right. Now, as I see this case, the issue is, how do we determine what is a foreign cause of action under 893.071? Would you agree with that?
I do believe that that is the issue.
So we have to come up with a theory, a rule that is applicable. And it can be a very general rule applicable to all contract actions, that you say this is a contract action. Or it can be a more narrow rule of this particular contract action, which is underinsured, right?
Right.
Okay. So, we've got several kinds of rules or theories, and we can make up another one. We've got the place of the injury. Now, if it's the place of the injury, you'd argue that this is Wisconsin's the place of injury, the injury being the breach of contract.
Well, I really believe, Your Honor, that we can have more than one place of an injury.
Okay.
And we can have more than one action, which I think has been pointed out. Here we have a Florida action against a Florida tortfeasor, and we also have a Wisconsin action for breach of contract against a Wisconsin insurer.
But I assume that you'd argue if we did place of injury that it would be Wisconsin for purposes of this underinsured motorist claim.
Certainly.
Okay. Another is place of accident, which may be different than injury.
That's correct.
If we do place of accident, what is the place of accident in this case?
Well, again, the place of the accident would only be applicable to the tort. But the place of the accident, which is, I think is correct, is a triggering event was in Florida.
Well, we could argue that we should use the same rule for tort and contract, because this is a contractual issue that only comes up because there's been a tort. And just to keep things simple, we ought to use the same state.
And I think that's correct. And I think in the Solhoff case, that's exactly what this court did when you looked at uninsured motorist, which is mandatory, required a mandatory endorsement. And this court said unequivocally that this is a contract case. It is not a tort case. And while if we may be required to prove up negligence in the context of this contract case, so be it. And I think the same rationale applies directly to underinsured motorists, but in coverage, but even more so. Not being mandatory, this is something that two Wisconsin residents specifically contracted for.
Let me ask you your understanding of General Casualty's argument. Is it your understanding that they're trying to argue that this is a tort, or that somehow we apply some parts of a tort analysis, or what is your understanding of their argument? Obviously, they will give their argument, but I'm curious as to your understanding of it.
My understanding of General Casualty's argument is that this is a foreign cause of action because the accident giving rise to the breach of contract occurred in Florida. The next step is, assuming the borrowing statute in its present form applies, we now borrow the Florida statute of limitations, 5 years. But their statute of limitations is substantially similar to our own, and it talks about accrual. So that doesn't help us. So now what we have to do is if we do this, in this case, we have to now go to Florida's substantive law interpreting the Florida statute of limitations, which imposes a burden not only on two contracting parties in Wisconsin. Now, two residents who enter into a contract to litigate a case in Wisconsin have to basically be at their peril, knowing what the law is in 50 states and perhaps other countries, and a circuit judge, such as Judge Montalban, in this case, is forced to be in a position to interpret a contract that's very clear.
Well, let me stop you for a minute, because my question is, you started your argument out this morning by saying this is a contract action. Is it your view that General Casualty is contesting that issue?
No, I don't believe the General Casualty is contesting that it's a contract issue, only that the issues are so intertwined that, and I think that they've actually analogized in their brief to this court that it's a tort in the veneer of a contract.
So one of the problems I have with the center of gravity test, and you accept that center of gravity test, you don't contest the trial court's use of the center of gravity.
Your Honor, we agreed. I just disagreed with the judge that when he used it, he came up with the wrong result.
And that's my concern. You look at the trial court's decision, and it seems to me that you're saying, what he's saying is right on, that the borrowing statute applies to contract, that this is a contract action. You look at the center of gravity test, and so he then applies the center of gravity test. And he says, well, let's look at Wisconsin. We've got a Wisconsin insured here. You have a Wisconsin insurance company. The contract's in Wisconsin. And then he says, but on the other hand, you have Florida. And however, plaintiff's claim under the policy involves Florida personal injuries resulting from a Florida accident with a Florida uninsured motorist. And then he gets the clinch sentence. If it were not for the Florida accident, Abraham's present cause of action would be non-existent. So it seems to me that really what we have is the judge doing the right analysis, and it seems for him that Florida's more significant. Why should we substitute our judgment for that? I mean, he did the balancing, and he just said, well, it's more significant. Florida has the center of gravity. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with it, I think, is it's kind of a which came first, the chicken or the egg type of an argument. The center of gravity test that's been applied, even by this court in Girton, looks at several elements. I think that when we talk about center of gravity, I think it's also been referred as the grouping of contacts.
If I may interrupt, that's exactly really what I want to know. What is it that should
determine in a center of gravity test. We have the balancing on both sides. Looks like the analysis is good by the trial court, but the conclusion you differ with. What is it that we focus on in a center of gravity test?
What is the center of gravity? What is the focus of this litigation? The focus of this litigation is a breach of contract. And the same argument holds true, Your Honor. If General Casualty hadn't breached their contract, we wouldn't be here. If Paul Abraham hadn't entered into a contract, we wouldn't be here.
But the center of gravity to Judge Montalban is, no, if there were no accident, you wouldn't be here. So that seems kind of amorphous. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have a breach of contract. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have an accident. So you're both wrong. I mean, what can we use?
Well, then are we required to enter a new contract in Wisconsin, and every time we enter into a contract involving underinsured motorist coverage, or for that matter, uninsured motorist coverage, go to some other state to litigate our contract case, or apply that state's substantive and procedural laws in Wisconsin? I think that's an onerous burden on Wisconsin residents, and I think it's an onerous burden to put on the circuit courts.
Let me ask you a question. I'm going to ask General Casualty the same question. If General Casualty were to prevail on their theory here, if we had a situation where somebody was vacationing in Florida and had something stolen out of their glove compartment, and they returned to Wisconsin and made a claim against their homeowner's policy, let's say, for recovery of whatever the worth of the item that was stolen, under General Casualty's policy, would the Florida statute of limitations apply to that situation?
I think it could, under General Casualty's analysis. I think it's more far-reaching than just UIM.
Well, what about Terra Nova's argument that the final significant event in a contract issue should be the governing factor?
I'll go back to the comment I made earlier, and that is, I think that's what the Court of Appeals is asking this court for as guidance. Judge Crabb made that very clear. I think that there is room for some hybrid, whether it be location of the injury, and then we determine what was the injury and when did it occur, whether it be center of gravity, which is more focused and type of a contract's conflicts analysis, or Judge Crabb, which is very similar to what the Effort Court decided, and that is when we look at the loss, what was the last event that occurred that gave rise to a suable claim? And in this case, the last event would be General Casualty's breach. That gave rise to the suable claim. So I think that this court is in a unique position to go ahead and fashion an approach.
So what do you suggest we fashion? We have to fashion an approach that works, not just that you win.
I wish that I always try to get it to come out that way, but the fact of the matter is, quite frankly, we believe that there is not a foreign cause of action, as I pointed out. However, to fashion an approach, I think that the location of injury approach is not inherently improper for this court to use that same approach.
Okay.
But the location of the injury doesn't necessarily have to be location of the accident,
right,
in a contract context. And that's where, when we use the center of gravity, I think that if you blend that in and we look at all these contacts, I think bright line is great. To have a bright line approach is significant, but simple bright line works well in a tort case, but may not work well in a contract case.
Well, but you're asking for a bright line when you say place of injury.
Well, I'm asking the court to give us a hybrid, if you will.
Well, your hybrid is place of injury, but in a contract case, the injury is a breach, place of breach. Isn't that your hybrid?
I think it can be.
Well, what is your hybrid?
Well, my hybrid is that I think that you can't just simply eliminate the center of gravity approach,
okay,
because of the fact that we deal with contracts that have Wisconsin residents, residents of other states, contracts are entered into in other states. With the internet, I think it makes it more difficult to determine where a breach occurred. So I think with all of that, I'm not saying let's just toss center of gravity out the window, but I think that there are more interests that have to be balanced than just where did an accident occur.
Well, since one of the legislative intents here was not to allow forum shopping for purposes of avoiding a statute of limitations or taking advantage of a particular statute of limitations, why shouldn't we interpret this to say, assuming there's some contact, we ought to take the state with the shortest statute of limitations? And here there's some contact with Florida. Florida has the shortest statute of limitations. Let's use that. That's a good rule. It's a bright line rule.
It's a bright line rule, but as a policymaking body, it's not fair to residents of this state. General Casualty, Your Honor, could build into their policy a time to commence an action. The legislature could see fit to limit the amount of time to commence this plan.
Okay, I'll change the rule. We could have a rule that, assuming that there's some contact with the state, that we use the longest statute of limitations. You like that better?
That's not a fair question. I like it better because it works in favor of my client, but I don't think we can make it that simple. I think that we still have to analyze a contract case, you know, on its merits, look at the respective elements, and if location of injury is significant in that analysis, then we use it.
Let me tell you one of the problems I'm having. The test that you're throwing out may all turn out to be the same. Chief, if I could just...
Go ahead. Sorry.
May turn out to be the same because all we've got is the accident in Florida and everything else in Wisconsin. But we potentially could have some things outside of Wisconsin, some of these other contacts, and it would make a difference as to which of the tests that you would apply if you had some other out-of-state context. I'm not going to ask you to answer it now. You'll have a chance in rebuttal. If you'd give some thought to, you know, which test that you're proposing to us is the best test, because it would have impact in other situations. So,
fine. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the General Casualty Company of Wisconsin, Mr. Gill.
May it please the court, counsel. In this case, this court is being asked to determine the timeliness of the plaintiff's claim for bodily injury damages on his underinsured motorist coverage with General Casualty. Plaintiff is seeking these damages as a result of an automobile bicycle accident that happened in Fort Myers, Florida on October 4, 1988. It is undisputed that the Florida statute of limitations for our underinsured motorist claims is 5 years from the date of the accident. If that statute applies, the plaintiff's claim is untimely and the trial court's judgment of dismissal must be affirmed. The plaintiff has argued both today in this court and in his brief that the 5-year statute of limitations from Florida should not apply, despite the fact that this claim arises from a Florida automobile accident. Plaintiff asked the court to apply the longer Wisconsin statute of limitations to his claim, or in the alternative, adopt only a portion of the Florida law and ignore the Florida rules on accrual. Both of these arguments should be rejected because they're contrary to the intent and purpose of Section 893.07, and they're contrary to the policy, the general policy, behind statutes of limitation. Plaintiff's argument first requires a review of the so-called borrowing statute, 893.07. If the plaintiff's claim for bodily injury damages under the UIM coverage is a so-called foreign cause of action, then the Florida statute must apply, according to our legislature. This case is before this court because the Court of Appeals certified it to you because there's a lack of Wisconsin authority interpreting Section 893.07 in the context of contract claims. And plaintiff has repeatedly stressed in his brief and again this morning in this court that his claim is a contract claim.
If I could interrupt you just for a second here, and let me ask you a question. The plaintiff have made a demand on General Casualty to pay a known amount of money the day after this personal injury accident?
Most likely not.
Could they have filed a lawsuit in Wisconsin, assuming that General Casualty says no and just forget the arbitration clause for a moment, could they have filed a cause of action in Wisconsin the day after the accident?
I believe so, yes.
And it would have been a viable claim that General Casualty could not have had dismissed based on the fact that there are no damages at that point?
Well, putting aside the issue of the arbitration clause, as you suggested.
Yeah, let's disregard that. What I'm trying to get at is, if we're using the date of the accident as the beginning of this cause of action, whether you look at Wisconsin law or Florida law, the question is it really the beginning of the statute of limitations? Was there a viable claim against General Casualty the day after the accident?
I think so, just like there would have been a viable claim against the tortfeasor.
So General Casualty could not have gotten that suit dismissed in Wisconsin if it had been filed the day after the accident?
I don't believe so, no.
Even under its contract that says don't bother us until you've collected everything you can?
Well, that is a common policy provision in these UIM endorsements.
And it is here, right? It's in this contract.
I think it is. I'm not prepared to dispute that it is. But I think it's also well known to this court, and it's a common practice that I observe, that these tort claims from automobile accidents are often brought simultaneously with the UIM claims. And then the burden falls on the UIM carrier to ask the trial court to stay the proceedings for a later determination of the UIM claim.
But you agree they could move to dismiss, saying that there hasn't been a breach under the contract, should they choose to. I mean, as a practical matter, they don't want to have this dismissed and restarted and all sorts of things. But legally speaking, they could have it dismissed because there has been no rise to a contract claim until the payments have been made, or at least offered by the other driver's insurer.
I'm not sure that I would accept that. I think that,
that
a tort victim could pursue both claims simultaneously. While the exhaustion of the underlying liability limits may be a prerequisite to recovery on the UIM endorsement, I don't think it's necessarily a prerequisite to a so-called suable claim.
Well, now, do you think the three years in Wisconsin, 3-year statute of limitations for personal injury applies, or do you think it's the 6-year contract action?
To a UIM claim in general?
UIM claim in general, that's right.
Well, I think that issue has already been settled by this court in Saulhoff, and it's a 6-year statute.
Okay, so this is a contract action?
In form, but not in substance, yes.
Okay. But as to the statute of limitations, it is a contract action.
It is.
If your form versus substance relates to how you characterize it for purposes of 893.071.
That's correct.
So you recognize it as a contract action, but you are going to argue that what determining what foreign cause of action means under the statute, you're going to say you're going to apply tort rules.
Look
to the substance,
right,
which is tort.
What we're asking this court to do is to adopt the same rule that it has adopted in tort cases in terms of determining what is a foreign cause of action under 893.07, but only in the context of these UM and UIM cases, which are really tort cases with a contract mask.
Well, let me ask you my example that I asked Mr. Abraham's counsel, Mr. Foley. What about the scenario that I gave you with the theft from the glove compartment? There's a theft from the glove compartment in Florida. There's a claim made under homeowner's policy in Wisconsin for payment. Which statute of limitations applies? If we were to adopt your theory of this analysis of the borrowing statute.
I've been thinking about that question since you asked it, Justice Geske. And my best answer is I'm not sure. But I think that there is a distinction between the type of claim that you've hypothesized and this type of claim. And the distinction is that in the form of the coverage. If you have property stolen, your policy says we will indemnify you for the value of that property. if you have UIM coverage, all your coverage provides you is the right to bring a claim if you can prove the negligence of the tortfeasor and damage beyond the tortfeasor's policy limit. And you are not in breach of contract by contesting either of those issues, which leads me to a question that Mr. Colby was asked earlier, when did the breach occur? I don't believe there ever was a breach in this case. A mere demand that is not satisfied by the underinsured motorist carrier does not amount to a breach of contract.
Well, does he have a cause of action at all? There's no allegation. I mean, you've conceded this as a contract action. If there's no breach, then there's no action at all, right?
Well, I think if you looked at it in the purest sense of contract law, that could be a problem. And I'm asking you not to do that in both adopting this rule of what's a form of cause of action under 89307, and in terms, I think, of the statute of limitations in general.
Well, I just to get back to it, if I make a demand and I write to the insurance company and say, I got a contract, here's the number, here's what's happened, pay me, and the insurance company phones me or writes me and says, no, you're not saying that's a breach? You don't think that's a breach?
Absolutely not. No.
Well, so when is there a breach?
The breach would be if there was a bona fide, legitimate request for us to comply with the terms of our UIM endorsement and submit any dispute to arbitration.
Wait a minute. Let's eliminate arbitration for a minute.
All right.
Eliminate arbitration. Same letter, same response. Is that a breach? I wrote to the right address, I wrote to the right person.
It is not a breach because you have no contractual right to any fixed sum of damages under underinsured motorist coverage. I'm sorry.
So what do? I write you 10 letters and you keep saying no.
Well, what you do is the same thing that you would do in the same accident if the tortfeasor had adequate insurance limits. If you can't agree upon a settlement figure, you either commence suit or you resolve the matter through some other means.
So now I commence suit and I file a complaint against you, sworn complaint, make a demand for payment, and you answer no. Do we have a breach yet?
I don't believe so.
When does the breach occur?
The breach would occur when there is a determination that you are entitled to a benefit.
Okay, so let's say that I have sued in Florida, and they've got a crowded docket, and it takes 7 years for me to get to trial. And so if I finally get a judgment for $200,000, and the policy course is only $50,000, so I come to you for my undercoverage under my UIM policy. Are you going to claim then that the statute of limitations has run, as you are here?
I would, and I think...
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and if I may explain why. I think the whole problem is that we're trying to fit what is basically a tort case into a contract concept of breach. And that's why I'm advocating to the court that the six-year statute of limitations that has been established in Solhoff on UIM cases should run from the date of the accident, because that's when you have a suable claim. When you have injuries due to the action of a tortfeasor that may exceed that tortfeasor's limits, you have a suable claim. It may not be meritorious.
Well, counsel, what if my injuries are such, for instance, that they're not fully determinable until 6 years or 7 years, which occurs all the time? You're saying that if I have, under those circumstances, I can't recover under my UIM policy?
I'm saying that you could certainly request a UIM determination in a timely fashion.
But I don't even know whether or not the coverage is going to apply, because I don't know the extent of my injuries.
Well, the same problem, Your Honor, would exist, though, with the tort claim. And the tort statutes of limitations are quite often much shorter, as they are in Wisconsin.
Again, let me propose, because I think what's happening here is you are arguing the merits of the breach as opposed to whether there's a sufficient allegation of breach. I mean, that's what I'm hearing, and maybe I'm wrong, but you're arguing, I assume that the plaintiff has alleged in the complaint that they were entitled to damages under the policy, and they may have specifically alleged that the other tortfeasor was negligent and there was not enough insurance. Those are all allegations at this point. If they could prove all those things, you agree there's a breach, right? I mean, if they can prove that, in fact, there was a tortfeasor that negligently injured your insured, that there's coverage, and that the damages did not cover the damages that Mr. Abraham suffered, that, in fact, there's a breach. Would you concede that?
I would say that at the time that there's a determination that they're entitled to benefits.
But isn't that true in any lawsuit? I mean, there's an allegation of negligence. You're not going to recover unless there's an actual determination of negligence. I mean, the complaint alleges negligence. It's sufficient to state a claim. You're not saying their complaint in this case isn't sufficient to state a claim for breach of contract, are you?
No. If I may step back, though, I think what the complaint, and I did not look at it just right recently, but I think what their complaint requests is a declaratory order from the court compelling us to arbitrate the matter, which is exactly the relief that I would contend they are entitled to.
They are entitled to? Except for the statute of limitations.
Except for the statute of limitations, correct.
I haven't done pleadings in many years, but can't you plead in the alternative, plead the tort case, and then in the alternative against the UIM claim?
I believe the answer is yes, and I think that that frequently occurs. An example of that is the Meyer case that was cited in our brief, where a UIM carrier was sued in the same action as the liability carrier and the tortfeasor, and then did not seek any relief from the trial court until near the trial. And then the court said, it's too late. You're in this case. You're here to stay. That was the holding. It was a court of appeals case. But I believe that that is, in fact, the common practice in Wisconsin at this time.
Here they ask for declaratory judgment for a declaration that coverage attends in this case. There's coverage. And then they ask that once the court makes that declaratory judgment that there is coverage, then it be ordered to arbitration to resolve the amount to be paid. Isn't that?
And the only dispute about coverage, quite frankly, was the statute of limitations, Your
Honor. That's right.
Now, counsel, let's get back to 893.071 for a moment. We are trying to define, as I see it, what foreign cause of action means, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so we need a test.
Yes.
Okay, a standard to determine what foreign cause of action is. And the way my notes read, we've got several tests. Place of injury, place of accident, grouping of contacts or center of gravity, or the final significant event. These are the four I've got. You've got any others?
I think those are the ones that have been discussed.
Okay. So, what's your choice and why?
My choice, as indicated in our brief, is that in UM and UIM cases, the place of injury should control because these cases are so remarkably similar to tort cases. It would establish a bright line rule. It would provide litigants with certainty. And in the context of this case and in most others, I don't believe that it would result in any unfairness. There is one crucial fact in this record, or maybe fact is too strong of a statement, crucial inference that I think this court should be cognizant of. Florida's a no-fault state. The plaintiff, in his correspondence, at the same time that he's making a demand upon General Casualty, is making reference to an entitlement to those Florida no-fault benefits. What we have is a situation where we have a Florida car accident that gives rise to three potential claims. The tort claim, which is clearly a Florida cause of action, the no-fault claim, which the plaintiff wants to treat as a Florida cause of action, and then the UIM claim arising from the same accident, in theory, the UIM claim would exist, that the plaintiff then says, no, I want to choose Wisconsin as being the place where that cause of action arises.
Counsel, is the no fault in this record?
I believe it is. It's mentioned in two places. There is a large group of attachments to the plaintiff's complaint that includes correspondence consistent with the vote notice that's given in Wisconsin in underinsured motorist cases, and there's reference in one of Mr. Kobe's letters to General Casualty about his desire to preserve his Florida no-fault rights. There is also reference to it in the answer filed by General Casualty. It's raised as an affirmative defense that the no-fault payments made by General Casualty in this case should serve as a set-off or credit to any recovery on the UIM benefits. I think that that gives you an example of why this should be treated as a foreign cause of action, because otherwise we have a plaintiff who can and will try to pick and choose their forum on a piecemeal basis, all from the same event, all from the same tortious event.
When you say plaintiff, you're talking about which plaintiff?
I'm talking about Mr. Abraham.
So you're saying that he could then, under what theory, if we hold consistent with what he's requesting here, could he make the UIM claim in Florida then? I mean, it seems to me that either he's going to be Wisconsin or it's going to be Florida. That he couldn't pick or choose between those two. How could he pick or choose? I don't understand. If we hold consistently with the petitioner's position here, how could he pick or choose between Florida and it would seem to me that either it's Wisconsin or it's Florida. It's in the matter of choice of forum.
I believe that he, in the past tense, he has chosen. He's elected to avail himself of the benefits of the Florida No-Fault Act, which would clearly be a Florida claim. Our contract, by virtue of Florida law, is metamorphosed into a no-fault contract. But
do you think he could have filed that claim in Wisconsin?
Pardon
against
me?
The driver? Do you think he could have filed that claim in Wisconsin and that he chose Florida? I don't understand the argument. It seems to me that the personal injury suit had to be in Florida.
Well, the no-fault claim would be a first-party claim against the plaintiff's own insurer. And that's the allegation that we've raised in our answer.
Let me ask you, what are you saying they should have done in this case? When should they have made the demand for arbitration?
Any time within 5 years of the date of the accident.
So they could have made a demand for arbitration the day after they filed or made the claim against the other driver in Florida. And what would General Casualty have done? They wouldn't have said, our contract says we don't do anything until you receive payment?
I don't believe that they would have had any choice but to honor the demand for arbitration. That may have been a matter of an affirmative defense, but in my experience, it is not uncommon for these claims to proceed simultaneously.
One of your arguments is that this is a foreign cause of action, therefore we have the Florida statute of limitations, the 5-year statute of limitations, and then you continue your argument that the accoutrements, the surrounding laws of statute of limitations should also be Florida. Seems to me that we have a couple of cases that are contrary to that assertion, Scott and Leverance, particularly Scott. How do you distinguish those cases?
Well, I'll start with Scott because that's the case that I'm far more familiar with. Scott involved a minor plaintiff who was injured in Alberta in some sort of a products case. And the question was, this court determined that it had to borrow Alberta's tort limit, statute of limitations. The question was, should the court also look to Alberta to determine if the cause of action is told during the plaintiff's minority. And I think that Scott is a statutory interpretation case. What the court did is it looked at the plain language first at 893.07 and then at 893.16 and concluded that 893.16 is part of the statute of limitations. In effect, what happens when a plaintiff brings a claim on a foreign cause of action, the statute of limitations becomes 893.07. And this court then had to determine whether the other provisions, statutory provisions, such as 893.16, are part of 893.07. And it did, based upon its interpretation of those two sections. The Leverins case, I'm not as familiar with. It is my recollection that involved a statute of repose issue. And I would distinguish it on the basis that what we're dealing with here is accrual common law rules. And the Florida court has already, done the work of interpreting when under its statute, 95011, I believe it is, this cause of action should accrue. And I feel that it would be appropriate for this court to defer to the judicial interpretation of that statute that's been already accomplished by the Florida court. I wish to stress to the court that this is a situation where if, as Justice Geske had suggested a few moments ago, the plaintiff could have obtained personal jurisdiction over the tortfeasor, Ms. Dulius, there would be absolutely no question about the fact that the trial court and every appellate court in Wisconsin would look to Florida to determine what the statute of limitations would be. I do not feel that the mere fact that the same plaintiff is now claiming the same type of damages due to the same conduct transmutes this somehow into a Wisconsin cause of action merely because at some point in time in the past there was a policy issued up in Wisconsin.
Is there any distinction between the injury sustained by the plaintiff in the law, tort action in Florida and what he's asking for from you on the contract?
The only distinction is that I think by force of law the plaintiff has to agree that the first, I believe, $25,000 of his claim has been satisfied. Otherwise, the proofs and the issues are identical, negligence and how much is the damage to the plaintiff as a result of his tort.
Under the Florida law, he can't just sue for personal injury. He can also include lost wages and everything else that goes with a normal claim.
I believe so.
We have five.
I thank you.
Gil, let me ask you, what's wrong with a center of gravity test in this particular case from your client's point of view?
I think what's wrong with the center of gravity test in general is that it forces the trial courts to do what amounts to a conflicts analysis to determine what the statute of limitations is. I do not fault the trial court in this case for doing that because at the time the trial court issued its decision, I think that the only published decision which tried to interpret 89307 in a contract setting was the office supply case. But since then, Judge Crabb has decided the Terra Nova case, and I think that her approach to the standard makes more sense. She says, and she extracts some language from the Girton decision that this court handed down, that the legislature simply didn't intend for trial courts to be doing a conflicts analysis to determine what the statute of limitations would be, and that's what the center of gravity would require. So she latched upon the last suable event as being the touchstone in a contract action. And here I would contend strongly that the last suable event was the automobile accident of October 4, 1988. There was nothing that General Casualty did after that point in time that would be a so-called suable event.
Let's assume that the center of gravity test is applied here. Is there any dispute in regard to Mr. Abrams' residency at the time of the injury?
Well, at the time of the accident, Mr. Abraham was staying in Florida. I think the record reflects that he was down there for employment purposes as an intern at a hospital, that his stay was of a short term, by that I mean weeks or months as opposed to years, duration, but he was in fact living down there and working down there at the time of the accident.
But your client didn't claim before the trial court that he was a resident of Florida, is that correct?
I don't think that we made that claim in the record. I think that would probably be a legal question that, very frankly, we never got into at the trial court level, the issue of residency. I would like to speak just briefly on the what I view as the second issue in the case, and I've addressed that with Justice Walsh Bradley a moment ago, and that is this accrual issue. I don't think that it's clear in Wisconsin right now when a UIM claim accrues. I think that the Effort decision is the only one that really tries to address that, and Effort comes up with two alternative approaches and says either one will work on the facts of this case, and so we're not going to decide the issue. I would submit to the court that the Florida rule handed down in the Kilbreath case would be the proper rule for Wisconsin to follow because it lends certainty. It's a bright line. There can be no dispute about when the tort occurred or when the accident occurred. There can be all sorts of disputes about when the breach occurred, as you've heard this morning. 5 or 6 years is not an unfair period of time for a personal injury claimant to come forward with the claim. We have extended the statute of limitations in UM and UIM cases by characterizing them as contract claims when all of the proofs involve tort claims. We force tort victims to bring their claims within 3 years. A bright line test of date of injury will not be prejudicial to tort claimants.
You know, the problem I still have with the argument is that if a claim was filed and against the tortfeasor and that case takes some time in the system, your policy says that the plaintiff is not entitled to any UIM benefits until such time as the payments and or whatever the language is, the judgment's been entered and so on. And I find it hard to believe that an insurance company's not going to raise that as a defense to a claim by a plaintiff that they're entitled to benefits. And so if the action takes a long time, the personal injury action, you're foreclosing them of any kind of viable statute of limitations. I mean, are you going to stand here and tell me General Cassidy's never going to raise that as a defense?
I'd like you to answer that.
Okay. Yes.
All right. I think it would be speculation on my part to say whether they would or they wouldn't, but I do have two responses to that. One is that there would be no reason why the UIM or UM claimant couldn't demand arbitration prior to the 5 or 6 year statute of limitations, whichever the case may be, and then the matter could be postponed if that was the wish of the insurer until there's an adjudication of the underlying tort claim. My other response would be that I think it's quite common for these two to proceed on the same track, especially in Wisconsin and I understand Florida, where there's direct action and the insurers are routinely sued directly on these types of claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Mr. Colby, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Members of the court, in terms of concluding comments, first of all, Your Honor, if somebody stole something out of my glove compartment in Florida and I made my claim against General Casualty, I think the same issue applies. It's a contract clause of action. If I make my demand here in Wisconsin, General Casualty is going to tell me to go to Florida and litigate the case in Florida. This is a contract case. It always has been a contract case, and General Casualty is asking this court, first of all, adopt the that it is a foreign cause of action, and you must adopt the location of injury rule. We've already addressed the location of injury. The second request that General Casualty is making is, once you've found that it is a foreign cause of action and that a foreign cause of action applies to contract, let's go to Florida, borrow their statute of limitations, but then disregard what the status of the law has been in this state in not only Scott and Leverance, but also the Johnson decision, where each time this court has said, we use Wisconsin law to analyze the applicable date of accrual on that statute of limitations. Thirdly, General Casualty says, and once we get past that hurdle, and we now can say it's 5 years under Florida law, and that accrues on the date of the accident, let's disregard what the majority of jurisdictions have done on UIM cases, and that is to find that the UIM claim accrues on the date of the breach. That's the majority decision. This Florida, in their Kilbreath decision, is a minority decision, and General Casualty is asking this court to accept the minority decision on addressing this issue under some guise that because Effort didn't have to deal with that case square on, that somehow we should reject what all of the other jurisdictions have done on this UIM issue and adopt General Casualty's position. And so, for me, well, I feel it's kind of unfair to say, what do I want? I think the flip side of the coin comes back to General Casualty.
And from experience, as this court is well aware, and the point is well made, this policy specifically requires that Mr. Abraham could not make any claim or do anything in terms of the policy that he had with General Casualty until the limits of liability under any applicable bodily injury liability bond or policies have been exhausted by payment of judgment or settlement. That's the predicate. If Mr. Abraham brought his action in Wisconsin, being on the flip side of that fence, I'm there routinely on motions for summary judgment and motions to dismiss on the basis that the UIM claim has not yet accrued. Mr. Kobe, when you're done, you've got your policy limits from the other company, then come back and talk to us about a UIM claim. And that's exactly what we're faced with in this case. Moreover, General Casualty's own policy provides that at any point in time, General Casualty can demand arbitration within the period of the statute of limitations that they believe to be applicable. Mr. Abraham did not make a rush to the courthouse steps. It took him nearly 2 years from the date of his accident to the time that he finally was able to resolve the no-fault and UIM claims in Florida with payment of the full limits on both available policies under Florida law, at which point in time he made a demand upon General Casualty for the balance of the limits that were available to him under General Casualty's policy. General Casualty said no. That is a breach. Within 6 years of that time, specifically September 30th of 1994, Mr. Abraham commenced a lawsuit against General Casualty, a contract...